You're now diving into the fish tank.
Sitting down with Seth Living, Seth, OJ, Juice Man, ooh, and this is strictly for them true fans, yeah. Dog fans, number one. One, of course y'all, this ain't no ordinary sports talk, dive up in that fish tank.
Welcome back to the Fish Tank right here on the Miami Dolphins Podcast Network. Seth Levitt with OJ McDuffie, who looks like he's in mid-season form. Praise Juice. How you feeling, man?
I'm feeling great, man. It's almost game time, isn't it?
It is game time. We're right in the middle of it. It's exciting. It's kind of weird, you know, no preseason, and here we are playing ball, but there's nothing better. There's nothing better, man. I wish we could be out there smelling the grass and hearing the guys collide and everything else, but this will have to do. We'll Zoom it and watch it from TV, but it's fun to be in season. But when we're in the tank, it's always fun to take a look back. And you knew this guy even before I did, Juice. And the PR side, he was a big pain in the ass to the PR guys. He was a hell of a reporter. He kept us on our toes and has been an unbelievable friend to the Fish Tank since we started, since day one. He's listened to every episode, gives me the critiques, gives me some ideas. Jason Cole, welcome to the tank.
I have arrived. This is beautiful. Like, I love this podcast more than any other podcast I listen to. And there are
a lot. We appreciate that.
But this is number one. And to be here, finally, I've been on a lot of things, ESPN, a lot of other stuff. Now, this is it. This is home. This
is it. Praise, man. That's awesome, man. That's awesome, bro.
So, Juice, you know, guys who get drafted, right, and they, you know, Zach can tell you every linebacker that was drafted ahead of him, whatever. How pissed off are you when you're hearing Hyde and Armando and Darlington? Are you tired? Is it hearing other media guys to get on here before you?
I just figured you were waiting for the best.
Okay, I like it.
Like that you were waiting for the ultimate journey through coverage of the Dolphins. And you had to warm up to me. Because yeah. I'm not for everybody. And Juice and Seth will tell you that.
That's a fair point.
I think the best way it was put is, I think Zach Thomas once came up to me and goes, you got a nickname with it off of your initials, JC. We call you Jumper Cables because you're always trying to start some shit. And I was like, yeah, that's true. I can't argue with that. That's true.
I like that. Jumper Cables. I forgot all about that. But Zach, when he was in his – and we'll get into that. But when he was in his mode, I mean, he's accused the Dolphin Digest of trying to start shit.
I'll start with this. So – Zach, guys would always ask me, like, who's your source, you know, like, and they were trying, like, negotiate with me, and I always look at them and go, look, guys, I can't tell you that, because if I tell you who my source is, you can't trust me anymore. Like, I can't keep anything secret. If I can't keep that, I mean, it's a really basic thing. But, so, I'm talking to Zach one day, and he was coming back from one of his high ankle sprains or something like that. You know, he had that one year, and it was really bothering him for about 4 to 6 weeks. And as he's telling me about this, he's like, you know, I'm not sure I'm going to be able to come back right away. He goes, don't put that on me, but, you know, I don't know how quick I'm going to be. I don't know how, you know, I'm going to be able to handle the coverage and stuff like that. And I'm like, okay, cool. But I'll write that, you know. And so I write, like, in the paper for, you know, this is on a Wednesday for the next day. I say, you know, there are some people in the organization who are, you know, concerned about how Zach is going to be in coverage, right? So Thursday comes, he comes up to me and goes, who said that about me in coverage? I'm like, you did. What are you talking about? It was you.
Mm-hmm. There are a lot of guys who would do that. There were guys who ran some teams, both on the field and off the field, who would get upset. Yeah. They'd come down to our office all the time, and I'm thinking, you don't remember saying that? Like, what do you mean? So listen, we're going to get into all these stories. We're going to get into all these stories, Jason. But we also, I can't ignore the fact that, and the reason we did wait, one of the reasons we wait is that you have yet another book that is, as folks are listening now, they can purchase this book. It is officially released and available to the public today. And I congratulate you on, this is what, your seventh book? You know, so, yep. So you've written seven books, which to write one is unbelievable. You've written seven. Mm-hmm. And so it's Elway, A Relentless Life. It's officially available today. But that begs the question, how the fuck do you drop a John Elway book on Dan Marino's birthday? That is, Juice, that's the most
exactly
shit exactly I've ever seen in my life.
Actually, we didn't just drop the book on his birthday. I mailed a box of Elway books to his house, hoping that he would do the Pac-Man Jones and just burn them on video or something like that.
Well, he likes John, but I mean, it's his birthday.
Okay, all right. Number one, I'm a dumbass because I did that. And if you have Danny as a drop going, yeah, you fucking idiot. You know, like if you have him doing that, I wouldn't blame you at all. Okay, but let me just say that when the publisher called or sent me an email saying it's September 15th, I immediately called the editor and I said, can you please just move it? And he's like, well, what's the big deal? I go, can you just move it a day, like to the 16th of the set? Just can you move it one day? He's like, what's the problem? I go, it's Dan Marino's birthday. And like, this is going to make me look like a bigger asshole than I already am. Okay. Can you just not do this? And they're like, oh, whatever. Yeah. We're putting it on the 15th. So yeah, my bad. And Danny, yeah, he can MF me. It wouldn't be the first time. So, you know, what the hell?
I'm sure it wasn't, and it won't be the last. Well, we'll get into the book in a little bit. Not before we talk some Dolphins and Dan Marino, that's for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. But the book was great. John Elway, went to college with him. Obviously one of my favorite athletes of all time. I love Danny, too, so don't get that wrong. But John Elway, A Relentless Life, been working on this for years, and it's out now. And even if you're a Dolphins fan, please read it. Please buy it. You know, enjoy it because there's a lot of reference to Elway. I mean, to Marino and that as well.
Well, you know, I mean, I know we're kind of off script here, Seth, but you know, I hated John Elway growing up. I'm a Cleveland Browns fan, What he did to my team a couple times. Look at these. I see you, Jason. I couldn't stand Elway, man, and the drive and the fumble and all that stuff that happened in my lifetime. You know, growing up in Cleveland, Ohio, you know, this is a double-edged sword right here when you want to drop this on my man Marino's birthday, as well as a Cleveland Browns fan who does not like Elway whatsoever, Jason, man. You know, you and I had a rocky start, man, but we were cool, I think, at the end. I know we're great right now, but damn, man.
It's going up and down right now.
So right now, Harvey Green needs to jump in and say, all right, OJ's got to get taped. We're done. We might have to end this one.
Harvey had to jump in more than a few times.
Let's just say that. I know. We got a lot to talk about today, as you know, and I'm definitely looking forward to a lot of things that, you know, specifically that we want to get into. But let's just start first, you know, talk about your overall mindset, Jason, you know, as a reporter. Mm-hmm. You know, you talked about the sources and things like that. But I can say from my perspective as a player, you know, you covered fairly, if I can say that. You were that dude, man. You know, anytime we saw you coming near us or, you know, across the locker room, you know, we had to be on our toes because, you know, we knew that you were going to come with something and we had to be prepared to say the right thing. And it's a lot different now, you know, than there's the social media aspects or the, mm-hmm. you know, all the different things that happen, man. But even then, you know, we had to be on our toes because, you know, and honestly, you like I said, you were fair and you knew some shit that I didn't think that you would possibly know. I don't, you know, and I guess you do have your sources.
Oh, you know, you find things out. But I mean, I think that it was, oh, my mindset was I was pushing as hard as I could to get the best story I could possibly get. And yeah, you know, I wanted to get deeper stories behind the scenes. I mean, there was some stuff that I didn't care about. Like I didn't care about guys, stuff that they did behind closed doors. But if it affected football, I really wanted to know about it. I wanted to get inside their head. And the other thing is when you're watching a game, and yeah, you guys might win, you might lose. And so you react to that. But then my thought process was, if I'm a coach, and I'm not that I knew that much about football, I'm not going to sit here and pretend that I understood a lot. But I would say, what is a coach thinking about what's going on here? And what does he think's got to improve? Because that's kind of the tension. Like you guys play a game. Win, lose, you go and analyze that game and try and figure out what you got to do next to win the next week or to, you know, whatever you're going to try and accomplish that season. And so I would try and think critically like that. And, you know, I think a lot of reporters just want to get sound bites. Like you get the TV and the radio people, they come in like, oh, just give me a sound bite to get me through this week. And you guys knew that, the play of that game, right? Get them whatever they needed. But it's like, that's not really what readers want. They want to know, you know, what is really going on inside the team as it's trying to build, it's trying to win, trying to go somewhere. And that's how I approached it. And the very simple philosophy was, as long as I was writing the truth, I was going to be okay. if I screwed up and I didn't write the truth, then I was going to have to pay for it. But that's why I tried really hard to make sure that I got the truth out of the situation. And yeah, it would get on some people's nerves. And Seth and I, we might go around and around a couple of times. And Harvey might, and I might go around. And Jimmy Johnson and Shula and, you know, everybody, I might go around and around a couple of times. But nobody could ever sit there and say, you're lying or you fabricated something. And as long as that was there, I figured I would be okay. Other than that, I pushed hard.
You know what? I will say this, though, Juice. There are guys who write and who do, they use the jumper cables and they start some shit, and then you don't see them. And I will.
That's for sure.
Very specific moment here in a little bit. But Jason would always show up. He would always show up the next day. So, you know, and you had to know walking in that when you were going to walk into something. You know, what's the mindset when you know you've just blown up somebody's spot in some way, shape, or form, and you're heading into that locker room? And you're not only going to have that guy mad at you, but maybe like his entire position group, maybe the PR guy, perhaps a coach or two. You know, what's that like walking in?
Don't duck. Don't hide. If I said some shit about the wide receiver group, you better walk into that corner and you better stand there. And if guys were pissed, give them their chance to say it. Because I remember one time, Mark Clayton came in. This is out long after Clayton had got cut. And he was talking to Armando, and Clayton was talking shit about something, right? Because Clayton was always talking shit about something, right? And so he was like, yeah. And Armando said, can I have, you know, let me say something. And Clayton goes, fuck that. I read your shit. You got to listen to me now. And I'm like, he's right. Like, I had my chance in the paper, right? Like, to write whatever the story was, I put it out there. I better walk my ass right up there. And if you got something to say, say it. And if you don't, well, you can't blame me that you didn't have a chance to say whatever it is you wanted to say. And I'm going to show up the next day. And I also remember one time that Greg Cody wrote a column one time ripping the wide receiver group, and he didn't show up for about 3 months.
Yep.
And Lamar Thomas remembered that shit.
Yep.
And Lamar Thomas got into Cody's face because Greg let it linger. And that was proof to me that you better deal with it right away and let guys have their say.
LT, yeah,
Jason, it's kind of like players, right, Jason? I mean, if you go out there in the field and, you know, you have a bad game and you duck out the back door, you got to get up on the podium. You got to get up. You got to face the media. You have to do that, you know, and it has to go both ways. So if you say something about a player, then like you talk about, you got to man up and be able to face that guy in that locker room. Like, it's a grown man's world right there with everything.
Absolutely. Oh, yeah. Let me say that. I learned more about it's an alpha male, grown ass man world in a locker room. I learned more about that than any point in my life. This is guys' livelihoods. This is what they do. This is what they have pride in. This may be a game, but there's a lot of shit on the line, and it means a lot. Now, what you eventually find out, and I think Juice, we've joked about it a little bit, is you get removed from it. It's like, okay, it's not really as serious as I thought it was.
Right.
But when you're in it, it's real, and you better respect that it's real while you're there, whether you're media or whether you're a player. And I think that was really important. And so, yeah, got to show up.
And you did. Now, you just mentioned Mark Clayton. You started covering the team in 1992, correct?
Yep.
And that was really the last year that Danny had Duper and Clayton at that big three, the original big three in Miami, right? Well, actually, no, the original big three was probably in the 70s, right? But that those guys, that they were all together. What was it like covering them? You're talking about some really dynamic personalities in the twilight of their career, particularly with the receivers, the tension that existed with Gary Stevens. What was that whole dynamic like for you?
Oh, look, when you're covering guys at the end, they're twisting, you know, trying to hang on and angry sometimes. Like Duper was angry a lot that year, you know, because he tried to get a new contract before the season and he held out like the day after Hurricane Andrew hit. And that didn't go over particularly well. And then Clayton knew during the season that they weren't going to bring him back because he had been such a pain in the ass to Shula for so many years. And, you know, and then when they brought in Keith Jackson, those two guys were pissed because I was taking balls away from them in the middle of the season. And Keith, you know, Keith is a really smart guy who's got some serious arrogance to him, and his arrogance didn't work with Duper and Clayton's arrogance. And so it was just a bad situation with a team that did okay and obviously made the AFC championship game.
That's okay.
Hadn't had a chance, but the inner turmoil of that team was really difficult to overcome. Like Bobby Humphrey that season, he came in and he was a really important role player, but you know, I mean, like everybody knows the story. He showed up like 20 minutes before the AFC championship game and was out of his mind because he'd been out drinking and partying the entire night because his personal life was a wreck. I mean, there was all sorts of stuff that happened that particular year in 92 that they had to disassemble the team, but at the same time, build it back really fast. So you go get a guy like OJ to replace, you know, Clayton right away. You're bringing in Irvin Fryer. You're going to dump Duper. There was a lot of bumping heads with people throughout the entire 92 season.
Yeah, we got Mark Ingram that following year as well. So yep. We did a lot, and of course, Tony Martin wasn't the player yet that he became. But so we had a little roster that was going to work. But yeah, you're right, though. I think the fact that Clayton – did we get a second-round pick for Clayton, Jason?
Not that I remember. I think he was let go as a free agent.
Oh, free agent. Okay.
And Duper, they eventually cut or traded right before the season started. And Danny was right. A little bit upset about that one, too.
Yeah, I remember
Duper. He thought Duper deserved a chance to win a roster spot. That didn't.
You know, Duper and I, we go back and forth about this, man. But Duper, he couldn't pass that down 12-minute run, man. You know?
Duper hated the 12-minute run. He could run sprints all day. But if you asked him to run distance and time, he hated that.
Right.
God, oh, man. There's nothing that Duper hated more than that.
Yeah. And then, of course, you know, we talked about the players, but and we had Clayton, and he had his frustrations with Gary Stevens. We know that. You and Gary had a unique relationship as well.
Gary is a trip, man. I got to tell you, I have met a lot of coaches in my life, but very few had the kind of over-the-top chutzpah, like just confidence of a Gary Stevens, while also like sometimes doing some really, really kind of like questionable shit. Like I remember him throwing one into the corner of the end zone up in Buffalo. Do you remember up in the corner, that right corner of the end zone, like the wind would come howling down, right? Mm-hmm. And I just remember one game, like Bernie Parmalee's going off. You guys got a lead. Bernie's at like 86 yards in the first half. And at the end of the first half, they try and throw a couple of corner routes into that corner of the end zone. And the wind is just howling. And Danny releases it. The wind just knocks the thing right into the turf. And so after the game, like we go up to Gary. We're like, Gary, what the hell are you doing? And you know, why are you calling that route into the wind, right? Don't I just run Bernie and, you know, do what you can? He goes, you're going to go to Buffalo. And you're going to beat the Bills with Bernie Parmalee? Are you kidding? You're going to beat him with Dan Marino. And I'm like, I get that, but you can't throw in. Nobody's going to throw into that fucking wind, right?
No matter.
And so that would lead to, like, we would write stuff like, why are you doing this? And so, of course, like, we would write stuff in the paper, and he would come down from upstairs, and he would come into the writer's room. You remember, it was in the front corner of the building, right? Way back then. Now it's way in the back. You guys put us in.
Somebody got smart.
Yeah.
In the cheerleading room.
Part of the Soviet Union.
Put him in the bathroom.
But anyways, we're in the front, and Gary would come down. And so one of us had written something about, like, that kind of play that he had done. And he yells at Armando first, right? I'm on the phone in my corner. Armando's in his corner. Pat McManaman's over one. And he's yelling at Armando, did you write this shit? What is this shit you wrote? And Armando's like, I don't even know what you're talking about, right? And he goes, that's Pat. And he points at Pat, right? And Pat goes, I don't know. Ask that guy over there. And he comes right up to me. I'm on the phone. I have no idea where he goes. You wrote that fucking shit in the paper. What the hell was that? I'm like, what's going on? He would just lose his mind all the time over stuff like that. It was entertaining as hell. Then you would go up to him and ask odd questions. He was the best.
You write it? Did we find out what it was? Did you write it?
No, because he left the room before I finished the phone call. And I was like, what was this? And he's like, I don't know. Was just whatever, you know. But Gary would lose his mind like that. Him and Juice, you know, stories between Gary and Danny, like Danny in meetings. I always used to hear this, like, you know, Danny would look at the play, at the game plan, and he goes, I know all this fucking shit. What are you doing here? And Gary would go, come on, Danny, you got to stay in the meeting. He goes, no, this is the same old fucking shit. And he would walk out of the meeting and all that. I just love those guys.
I would tell you, man, and Danny and Gary got into it a lot in those meetings for shit like that. Or, I mean, it was pretty simple for Danny because he's been in that system for so long. So the game plan, yeah, for me was different. But for Danny, it was the same old shit.
just like to sit there and go, Gary, what the hell are you doing? I know this.
But they would do the dance. I would see Dan sometimes and say, have you seen Gary? Because Gary would always go out for his run, Drews, take his shirt off,
run, shirt off, smoke
a cigarette at the end of it, you know? And then, and so he would go out for his run. And Dan would say, have you seen Gary? I don't know. He goes, can you fucking believe a quarterback can't find his offensive coordinator to watch film? I was like, look, man, I'm just a PR guy. I didn't. They had a beautiful relationship.
And I wrote about the fact that he would smoke after his runs one time. I wrote that. I go, and I was like, why do you, like, you go out and you run in like 95 degree heat. You sweat like crazy.
Well, 100 laps. I mean,
you're having a smoke afterwards. Like, Gary, what the hell is going on here? And like, so I wrote it one time that, you know, he'd go for a run and a smoke. And he'd like, go, why are you writing that I'm smoking? I'm like, that's what you do. Like, what's the big deal? He goes, that's personal. I'm like, what? What world do you live in, Gary? I don't get you at all. But that was him.
But, yeah, hey, Jace, you know what? You know, we really have to address the elephant in the room. One of the most memorable encounters that I ever seen, and I think in my life as a sports guy ever. Let's just call it an encounter with Gene Atkins.
Oh no, he ran me over.
I know. Let's take it back.
I was the receiver who did the curl route and was just standing. And I didn't know that he was coming across because I didn't have the vision. Like, I had lost track of where the safety was, and he just took me out. Like,
wait a minute. So, I mean, were you defenseless receiver at that point?
Absolutely.
Did that rule exist back then?
The funny thing is, I'm the defenseless receiver, but he was naked. And
What set him off?
Here's the dumbest of the dumbest of the dumbest things ever. I wrote a column in which I was basically defending Gene, because at the time it was the salary cap had just come into place. And so he had all these rules about who could have contracts done and who couldn't. And long story short is, if you had signed a long-term contract before the start of the salary cap, the team could not restructure your contract. That was the rule. If you signed a contract after the start, which is in the 93 season, the team could redo your contract. So I think this is 94, 95, I think 95. So some player grouses to me about, oh, they just redid Gene's contract, but they're not redoing mine. And I'm not going to say who the player was.
Well, you can't. Wait a minute. That's 20 years later, man. You can't reveal sources.
No, I never.
The statute of limitations on this thing.
The statute of limitations hasn't.
Because they'll never trust me again if I say it. So, player complaint. The player says at the time he hasn't even made a Pro Bowl, and they're redoing his contract, which was true.
So wait, man, narrows it down a little bit to somebody that's made a Pro Bowl.
You guys are fine investigative reporters, and you can figure it out.
Yeah, I think we could also listen back to a previous episode of the Fish Tank.
That's fine. Well, I'm not referencing anything.
So I got you.
But anyway, so I basically go about and explain why they redid Gene's contract as opposed to redoing other players on the team, and that they couldn't. They were, you know, they were handcuffed by the rules. No fault of Gene's, okay? So don't complain about Gene, and don't grouse about Gene because he did this. Well, Gene, of course, I think Michael Stewart got in his ear, and Michael Stewart was like the puppeteer between those two guys. Michael Stewart thought he was just smart enough to like beat the reporters at the game. And so he planted a bunch of stuff about in Gene's mind about how I was ripping him. Gene gets up in the meeting, and I think, OJ, you were in the room when this, and he gets up and he goes, whoever said that shit, you know, I mean, challenged him to a fight in the meeting.
Right.
No, and everybody's like, you know, what are you talking about?
Something like a get your hand out of my pocket speech he gave.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah. And he's angry about it. And it's like, and then at noon, everybody's like, okay, you're angry at a player. We understand why you're angry at a teammate for saying what he said. Okay, that's fine. But then at noon, we all walk in, or whenever the media availability was. I'm standing like face-to-face with Steve Weish, now with NFL Network, who was working at the Herald.
Right.
And all of a sudden, I just get blasted. From this side, right, I get hit, knocked over. I'm looking up, and you know, I look up and there's naked Gene Atkins walking away from me, laughing.
He didn't run. He just kept going.
He hit me, and then he turned around and he walked away. And so I was like, "What the fuck is going on?" Because I was defending Gene, explaining the rules.
Right.
So I walk over and I go, Gene, and I put my hand on his shoulder. What's going on here? He grabs me around the throat and proceeds to choke me
in
anger. And I'm like, oh shit, this got real. That's when Harvey steps in And then Harvey, you know, like I walk over and I'm like trying to get my bearings about me. I'm talking to Jeff Cross and all the players are like, what the fuck's going on? And the media is like going, what the hell's going on? I'm just trying to like figure this out. And of course, Harvey like wisely closed the locker room and figured it out. And just, you know, later he's got me talking to Gene. And it was just, what was sad is that it was an indication of things that were to come for Gene, because Gene's career did not end well. And I think, you know, he had fights with teammates eventually, like Terrell Buckley and Sean Wooden. Anytime he felt like his position was threatened, he became a cancer in the locker room. There's no question about it. And it was, he was a problem. And, you know, his life deteriorated a lot afterwards. So, you know, it becomes a sad story, but it was, you know, I know a lot of players were laughing about when I got hit. And
that is legendary.
A lot of them were like, he deserves that shit.
They're still talking about it.
Man, I tell you, man, yeah, it was shocking when that went down. I was like, it's so weird for me because any time in that locker room, coming out of Penn State, we didn't see any shit like that. You know, we didn't see any problems or instances like that, man. And like we talked about earlier, Jason, that was like, for one, Gene was dead wrong for doing what he did. You know, if you want to be a man, you don't handle it that way in the locker room. You talk to Jason, you talk to whoever, you know, you have a problem, a conflict with. But it seemed like Gene handled conflict in that manner.
Gene was a really physically emotional guy.
Yeah, exactly right. You know, so it was like, it was shocking to me to even see some shit like that in the locker room. And to witness that. But here's the thing about it, Jason. You said it earlier. You write something and you show up. Right. And you didn't even know that Gene would have a problem with this, but you still show up. You know what I mean? And that's you know, you got to be commended for that, bro. Because a lot of these dudes hide behind, especially now, man. People write remotely now, man. It's terrible to see these sources and people writing and then, you know, show up in the locker room and say the same thing. We got a lot of, I call them keyboard tough guys.
Sure. Look, it's a different business, and that's okay. I mean, it all works out, and people still watch football, and it's great. And, you know, they eat up all the coverage, and it's great. But I think there's a lot to be said for just having a guy who goes in and covers the team and asks a lot of hard questions and doesn't always have an opinion. Again, the thing between me and Gene was not really an opinion. It was an explanation that somebody else got in his ear and tried to make it that I was ripping him, and Gene just didn't get it. And that was unfortunate for Gene. But, and for me, you know, it's all of a story though.
It's a hell of a story. But Juice, I've heard that story 1,000 times. I mean, legendary, especially being a PR guy. I never knew he didn't have any damn clothes on. I mean, at least put a towel wrap on, Gene.
Come
on.
He was buck ass naked, man. It made it a little bit worse, but yeah.
I think that's how you do it though, Seth, man. If you ever get into a fight with a guy you think can whoop your ass, man, take all your clothes off and then he probably won't want to fight you, man.
No. Oh, I mean, sure,
come on, don't piss out, you know what I mean?
Yeah, like you're like
that's
you're
the
like,
move.
I don't
want to that's the move, you let's go.
I don't know, man. That's an interesting one.
You certainly ain't gonna wrestle with him.
Right. I wasn't there for that. I didn't get in until 96. Of course, 96 was Jimmy Johnson's first season with the Dolphins. Mm-hmm. That year, Jimmy drafts some real characters on the defensive line, starting with his first overall pick, which was Darryl Gardner. OJ and I have talked about Darryl on the show. You know, it's a whole other set of circumstances. He drafted Shane Burton in the 5th round. Now, I bring up those two guys because it was a common theme with you and Darryl and Shane and Jimmy. And the theme usually was you writing shit, them getting pissed off. Maybe it's just a common theme in general. But with these guys, you writing shit, them getting pissed off. And then again, who are your sources? And there was kind of a cyclical relationship that you all had.
Oh, absolutely. The funny thing is I got along with Darryl because I liked crazy people. I like guys who were really different characters who were out there who had different stories. I loved covering Ricky. I loved covering Darryl. And unfortunately, Darryl wasn't as great a football player as he should have been. He should have been a truly great one. He flashed a couple of times. But those guys would create so much news about them, especially Darryl, because of the injuries and because Jimmy didn't trust him. Like, Jimmy drafted him knowing that he didn't necessarily love football and he wasn't totally bought in, but he was so super talented. Jimmy thought he could take him and mold him. And that became sort of a theme for Jimmy with a lot of guys that he drafted, is he thought he could change them or control them. And Daryl just wasn't, I think he liked the money. He liked the flash, but he didn't always like the work. And then he got hurt and it became a real problem. But there was a there was always a trust issue. And because of that, people were always saying stuff about Daryl behind his back, right? And because of that, I would hear that kind of stuff. And, you know, there's a problem in the locker room because Daryl is either talking too loud and hasn't proved anything. That was the first thing he pissed off all the veterans with. Or people didn't trust him. And like the one in New England where he gets stingers in both shoulders, right? And he doesn't finish the game. And, you know, when you get stingers in both shoulders, that's a problem. But a lot of guys thought he was jaking at that game and took himself out. And KO, Kevin O'Neill, the trainer, went up to Jimmy and said, no, this is more serious. So Jimmy didn't get into him because he knew he was legitimately hurt. What Jimmy didn't do afterwards was tell him that he actually had a legitimate injury because he was worried that he would skip practice as a result. So it was always stuff like that that was going on with guys like Daryl, and Jimmy's manipulating people. Shane had his own issues, you know, would get into trouble. But, you know, like there was all these little problems. And when you're covering guys, a team with a lot of guys who are not necessarily bought into football, don't love it, would get into trouble. You know, like if you bring in a Cecil Collins or a Clayton Holmes or all these guys, there's a lot of stuff that reporters have to do, like to keep track of what's going on with the team and what Jimmy's trying to do. And that, I'm sorry, that leads to a lot of anonymous sources. It leads to a lot of questions about who are you talking to? Where do you get this from? And it's a headache, man. I got to tell you that it's a headache. And then guys would challenge me. Jimmy was like, I know that your source is this guy. I'm like, okay, if you say so, like, what do you want me to do? And he would like challenge me or try and tell him who my sources were. And I was never going to do that. It's just kind of how it was going to be.
It's interesting you say that about Daryl Gardner, because, you know, and we recognize it as players. You know, and I'm really the only one to actually call him out on being not wanting to be out there and you know, trying to, you know, being a hard-ass veteran that I was, obviously undersized compared to Daryl. But Daryl really took offense to that when I called him out in a two-minute drill. And I know you remember that day. Like, dude, all I'm saying is, you know, we're in this – anytime you want to opt out, you know, in a conditioning drill or a toughness drill or just being mentally tough drill, which our two-minute drill was, That became a problem to me. But like you said, nobody wanted to call him out on a lot of things that he was doing, saying, or not doing. And took a little 190-pound wide receiver to get pushed 10 yards, almost killed 10 yards in practice to actually, you know, for people to actually start, honestly, defense started having my back a little bit more. I thought they had at the beginning, but I think they had even more after that point.
I always was dreaming about if Tim Bowens and Daryl Gardner had gotten into a fight. One of my favorite stories that I ever did was I went around the locker room and I said, if you were to get into a barroom fight with guys, who would you want on your side? And like guys would say, this guy. And I think it was Jay Williams. Jay was one of the defensive ends for a little while.
Yeah.
And so he tells me, oh yeah, I'd want to have like Brock Marion and this guy. And I looked at him and said, well, what about Tim Bowens? And he looked at me and goes, this is a bar fight. You don't want anybody dying.
Yeah.
And I was like, true. If Tim had just ever like just really got in Daryl's face, and you know, Tim wasn't like that, but Tim was the one guy on the team that nobody messed with. And nobody, you know, like from rookie year all the way through, nobody messed with Daryl. Like you just don't.
With Tim.
I mean, yeah. with Tim, I mean. And I just wish
everybody messed with Daryl.
With Daryl, and that would have maybe, I think, gotten more out of Daryl long term, but that's just the way things go.
I don't know. It might not have ended well.
Somebody might have died. And most likely Daryl, because Timbo's one of those guys who could have like lifted a car engine out of a car, right? Like you don't know how much weight Timbo could actually lift. But if you said, just take that engine block out of the car, like I get the feeling that Timbo just could, he would have lifted the engine block out. That's the kind of human being he was.
You know what, man? I mean, you talked about Timbo and he was there a couple years before Daryl got there, and talk about Big Shane a little bit. But I mean, how can we not mention the great Zach Thomas, who was in that draft class as well, you know? And we know what happened when you and Zach got together on the basketball court. But since we're talking about sources, you know, what's this thing about Zach and Cheetos and paranoia and things
well,
like that.
Paranoia, we talked about the paranoia earlier, and he'd always, you know, go, he would tell you something and he'd forget you'd tell you something. Beth, you referred to that a little bit. But I just love, the thing I loved about Zach is the notebooks, man, like the pile of notebooks. Like he would write down notes for preseason games. He would want to look good. He, you know, he just worked at it so hard. And you guys talked about when Zach was on the show, but just admired it. But it started so early. It started back in college. And he would like, before he got really into nutrition, once he got to the NFL. So in college, he'd go buy a bag of Cheetos and he would get the game film. And so he'd be eating the Cheetos, writing down his notes, eating the Cheetos, writing down the notes. And then he would like turn off the switch, right? Without wiping his hands. So this house, throughout the entire house that he was renting, his like he had like three roommates, there's like Cheeto crud and dust on every one of the switches throughout the entire house. Like all the light switches were that yellowy orange gooey Cheetos color. So that to me was like that's the sign of you're so into it, you don't even care what the house looks like. It's just, it's disgusting. And that's kind of like, that tells me what you need to know about Zach.
Cheetos.
He just had Cheeto dust everywhere. And it would have happened in the Dolphins facility if he hadn't have improved his diet.
Fair point. So now, Jason, you have a Hall of Fame vote.
I do.
And I know that you have for years been, you always tell me, I just want to get Zach in the room. I just want to get Zach in the room. And
we got him in the room this year.
Did get him in the room this year. And we can all only hope that he gets that jacket here sooner than later. Mm-hmm. Do you say this is all you need to know about Zach Thomas and tell him the Cheeto dust story?
No.
That's probably not the wrong place.
That ain't enough to get in the Hall of Fame, Tom. Okay. That shit ain't enough. Okay. It's a cute story. It's not
Hall of Fame worthy.
The gold jacket does not get Cheeto.
Because if that's all it takes.
Like that doesn't happen. Okay. I tell him about like the interceptions, against, you know, where he did a backflip into the end zone, or the interception at the 1 yard line against the Raiders, where he catches it and takes one step and he scores, or the times that he's playing games with Peyton Manning at the line of scrimmage and they're calling play, like Peyton's calling a play, Zach is calling it back, Peyton's calling, like you can see they're on the chalkboard with each other trying to figure out who gets the last piece of chalk and who gets to call the play. And that stuff was genius to me, like those kinds of things. And the things that guys like Peyton say about him and how hard he worked at it and how much, you know, he basically, if he had been 6'2" instead of 5'10", you know, he would have been a first round pick. He would have been, you know, right up there with the guys like Brian Urlacher and Ray Lewis, but he wasn't. He was 5'10" and not the most athletically gifted guy, but certainly athletic enough to be on the field all three downs and be in coverage, and smarter than anybody that you'll ever see on defense. Now, the defensive guys are not necessarily the brightest guys in the world, and OJ will tell everybody.
Yeah, they're not.
We just had Trace Armstrong on. That's a smart man right there.
Well, yeah, Trace is an exception. He should have played tight end. But, you know, like Zach is just – he's going to get there. And all I know is that last year, when I prepare for the Hall of Fame vote, I usually talk to about 300 people every year.
This is fascinating, by the way, Jews. His process.
Who have been in or around football for at least 20 years, right? The NFL. Like they were coaches, they were players, they were executives, some kind of combination. You spent two decades in the NFL, right? And I survey those people because they know. And let me just say that last year I had four coaches from the Patriots staff who coached against Zach. And that was Ivan Fears, Josh McDaniels, Bill Belichick, and Dante Scarnecchia. Zach swept those four guys. They all put him in his top five last year, in their top five. So I feel very confident that someday along the line, I said that during the meeting. So I feel very confident someday Zach's going to get there. But it is a numbers game and it's a hard thing. So I hear this from Dolphins fans all the time that, you know, they're not ready. You know, they're not understanding why he's not in the Hall of Fame yet. And I get that, but I do think that he's going to get there one day, and the momentum is building in the right direction. So just hopefully people can be a little bit patient.
Yeah. What's the expression is like Zach's playing chess and everybody else is playing checkers.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Like again, like you would see that him and Peyton, like there are times when those guys are like, basically they're almost talking to each other. Like, I know you're doing this. You know, I'm doing that. I know you're doing this. You doing that. And it would go back and forth all the time. You would just see it. And yes, he was the smartest defensive player in the league for probably a good 5 or 6 year stretch. No question about it. And he got those guys in the right place.
Yeah. Would you be surprised if Zach actually said sometimes like dummy signals too? So Peyton would think that, you know, I'm checking, but I'm not really checking, but you know, just so he thinks that they're on the same page. I mean, that test game goes deep, I'm sure, right?
Oh, I'm absolutely certain of that. Because you know what? I was watching when they did the 100 greatest players and they did the Ed Reed segment. There's one where Belichick is talking to about Ed Reed. And he's like, you've faked out Peyton by putting your shoulder inside and looking in over the middle, even though you were going to cut back and you knew he was going to throw the outside. Like the gamesmanship that goes on between high-level, really smart defenders and quarterbacks, that is chess. And it is brilliant to watch. And Zach was brilliant to watch and fun to really cover. And I just have such great appreciation for Zach. And there's other guys, you know, Richmond Webb, you know, I wish he would get in the room for discussion too. I think he deserves discussion. I'm not sure he's a Hall of Famer. And Zach, you know, it's sort of like, you know, John Lynch is another one of these guys who's been on the cusp for a long time. And you just wonder, are the numbers ever going to work for a guy like that? And
Jason, how do you decide if a Richmond Webb is, you know, considering, you know, that position is, there's not a lot of numbers you can really go by, sacks allowed, whatever. Mm-hmm. But when you're going against a guy like a Bruce Smith, you're in and out. I think that, you know, and I know Jason and Seth and those guys work really hard about the Tom Brady situation, how Tom Brady respected Jason Taylor as a Hall of Famer. Mm-hmm. Isn't there a guy like Bruce Smith that could validate basically Richmond Webb's position possibly in the Hall of Fame, considering how he handled him for the most part? I know Bruce got his things on too, but the Dolphins drafted Richmond Webb because of Bruce Smith. So, I mean, how do you get an offensive tackle into the Hall of Fame?
And look, we've had a problem here the last couple of years just getting – we've been stuck on these four guys for a long time, and up until 2 years ago it was Kevin Mawai, Steve Hutchinson, Tony Baselli, and Alan Faneca. Okay, these four guys, and we had this log jam of these guys, and then Joe Jacoby was there, you know, and so we've had the toughest time in the world trying to decide among those guys. We finally got Mawai through 2 years ago, and this last year we got Hutchinson through, and now, you know, Baselli, you know, or Faneca is going to be next. But you're right, with offensive linemen, it's the hardest thing in the world to do. And again, Richmond, I'm hoping that his time doesn't slip by before we get a chance to put him in the room. But, you know, like if you tell me, like, I got to be honest, if I've got Tony Baselli and I got Richmond Webb, I'm thinking Baselli's probably a better player. Richmond probably had a better career. But Tony Baselli, like when you draw up what a left tackle is supposed to look like, it looks like one of three guys. It's either Anthony Munoz, Jonathan Ogden, or Tony Baselli. And those guys are.
Why Baselli? I need, can you give me more?
Baselli, yeah, just, I mean.
The quickness, it's both the size, the reach, the height. The everything and the quickness. Like if you're talking about him against Bruce Smith and Derek Thomas, he would erase those guys.
He would erase them. That's a hypothetical.
Oh, he did erase. Hey, look, I love your boy Jason Taylor. Let's not get into this, but Tony Baselli did this to Jason Taylor one time. And you know.
So this is the issue with Tony.
No. You know what he did to Jason, okay? And he's a great. Tony Baselli is a great. Great left tackle, and Jason Taylor's a great defensive end. But I would say that if you were to construct what a left tackle is supposed to look like,
doesn't matter, right? So I mean, isn't there also consistency and longevity
ability yeah.
to do it for over a long period of time and not just?
Oh, absolutely. Look, it is absolutely part of it. Look, the problem with the Hall of Fame is at the end of the day, it's kind of like a giant smell test. Like, do you smell like a Hall of Famer? And sometimes you do, and sometimes you don't, and it gets really, really hard. And, you know, stats are really important, but sometimes
But that's Juice's point. You know, with a tackle, what are the stats? What are you measuring?
Right. Well, look, Tony Baselli probably would have been in the Hall of Fame already if he hadn't had such a short career.
And that's the problem right there. Longevity's a part of it, right, Jason?
Don't you think? Absolutely. Look,
longevity.
There are all sorts of factors that go into whether a guy – is a Hall of Famer.
Right.
Is it longevity or is he a shooting star? Was he at the top of the game for 8 to 10 years?
Like a Richmond Webb?
Was he a guy who just compiled numbers for so long? Like Frank Gore is going to get in the Hall of Fame, right? But is Frank Gore the most electric running back that you have ever seen in your life? No. Was he the game-changing running back you know, Curtis Martin was the same kind of way. Was he a game-changing type of running back, or was he a compiler of numbers who had a great career and was tough as nails and is emblematic of what a football player is supposed to be like? That's, we're always arguing that back and forth, OJ. You're exactly right. It's really hard to figure out. And that's why I say, Tony Boselli, if you're like if you're having an argument between Richmond Webb and Tony Boselli, and I love Richmond Webb. I love Richmond Webb. But I got to say, Tony Boselli, I think was a better left tackle and probably deserves to get in first. And we got to get him out of the way before we get to Richmond.
No, I mean, let me just say.
That's crazy.
Better, you might consider him a better left tackle, but we talk about, I mean, how many straight Pro Bowls and all that? I know Pro Bowl. I'm not a big Pro Bowl fan because I led the league 1 year and didn't make the Pro Bowl. But Richmond Webb was a Pro Bowler every single year for like, what, the first 7-8 years of his career?
And Juice, you know what I think happens?
And I wish he would get in the room. And I wish we could bring that up and discuss it. But we have this logjam of other guys who we're having a double.
But they're guys who came after him, Jason. I think that's what a lot of people have an issue with. These are guys that they're guys who came after Richmond. There's guys whose tenure came after Richmond's. And so it's almost as if his window has closed and he's kind of been forgotten. I have a question for you. We talked about Clayton as well, who I think, to you know, in the era that Clayton played in, I think he has Hall of Fame numbers. You know, I really do.
That's right. There's a good argument to be made, and I heard your argument for it.
So. Yeah, and so what I wonder is how much are guys being penalized for Dan being so great? You know, because I've heard that amongst other voters, and I've learned a lot, you know, when JT went through the process. But how much are guys – well, he played with Dan Marino. Well, Dan Marino got rid of the ball fast. Which Dan – I mean, look, Dan is one of the greatest who's ever done it. But does that mean that Richmond Webb wasn't a superior left tackle? Does that mean that Mark Clayton scoring 18 touchdowns, you know, breaking it, like, does that, it took Jerry Rice to break his single season record. Does that mean that those guys were not at the top of their game in the era that they played in?
No, those guys were in the top of their game. I just think that their numbers, for whatever reason, are lost. And like Clayton played right on the cusp of when the numbers started to get crazy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Jerry Rice, and the rules changes get really wide open and guys get to 1,000 catches. And I know there are numbers that support Clayton. I'm not trying to say that. But now, like, if you don't have 1,000 catches, like, you're almost not even part of
it. But he's on the cusp of it. He was prior to that.
I know he's prior to that, but it's right in that in-between stage, right? And it becomes really, really hard. Like, somebody was the other day, I saw this, somebody said, how the heck is Steve Largent in the Hall of Fame if you look at his numbers? I'm like, wait a sec. Steve Largent, when he retired, was number one in catches, number one in receiving touchdowns, number one in receiving yards. He got blown away by all the guys who came in the 80s, 90s, and afterwards. No question about it. But if you saw Steve Largent play in the 70s and early 80s, he was the standard until Jerry Rice took over. He was the guy. So numbers kind of change it really fast. And Clayton, unfortunately, is playing right about the same time as Jerry Rice has taken off and putting up his kind of numbers. And then the game really explodes around the entire NFL. And it's unfortunate because I think Clayton's numbers get lost as a result of that. And like, and Richmond's the same thing. Richmond played in probably the greatest era of left tackles in terms of depth ever, you know, because you've got Orlando Pace comes along. You've got, you know, Ogden comes along right after that. Then you have who's guy played in New Orleans and Kansas City? I'm trying to remember right at the moment.
Willie Rolfe.
Yeah, Willie Rolfe. Yeah. Willie Rolfe. And you've got
– those guys are all in.
Walter Jones. Yeah, they're all in.
Sure.
But, like, it's like the table gets set between Munoz and those guys with Richmond right in between.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden Richmond is getting left behind. And I understand it. And that's why I wish we could get Richmond in the room. But I don't think we're going to get Richmond in the room until we get Fanica and Boselli through. And that's what I'm trying to explain.
Well, this is going in a whole other direction. We're going to have right. some words about this afterwards, Jason, yeah. for sure.
Great conversation. So look,
I'm going to jump ahead. I'm going to jump ahead to Jimmy's final season, 1999. Crazy year from start to finish. All right. But I want to start at kind of the beginning of that season. As you know, your former colleague at the Herald, Armando Salguero, was in the tank, told us perhaps one of the most glorious stories ever told. Here
well, it depends on who is part of the board.
Well, that's what I want to know. So for those who haven't heard it yet, definitely go back and listen to that episode. But it essentially involved a very angry Jimmy Johnson. It involved certainly a Jason Cole, who's going to share with us your perspective on it.
Jimmy was not naked. He was not.
Not naked. Negative. No, you come right off the practice field. He came right off the practice field.
Oh, no. He didn't come off. No. He left the practice field in the middle of practice.
Yes.
To get me and Stu and Harvey and Armando.
Oh, yeah.
And get in my shit. Okay.
Yeah.
So what had happened is earlier that year, I mean, the signs that Jimmy had sort of checked out, you know, he had almost quit. He had that thing where he cleared out his office.
He did quit.
And then he came back because they brought Wonstead in, you know, to be the babysitter.
Should have quit.
Keep Jimmy happy. That whole thing, that drama where Wayne had to come in, you know, calm everybody down. And then about, I think it was June of that year, Jimmy skipped out on this meeting of all the coaches in the NFL that was supposed to take place in Atlanta. He sent Wonstead up to that in his stead because he just wanted to stay in the Keys. He didn't want to leave. So I knew about this, didn't write about it. Okay. Then, if you guys remember, the third day or the fourth day of training camp that year, Jimmy called for like a mental health day. Right? Like you guys had a scrimmage and he gave everybody in the entire building the next day off. OJ, am I right?
Yep.
The entire organization. This is training camp. He gives the entire staff and the players the day off. I come into the office that day going, okay, what's going on? Harvey comes down and says, don't write about this. Don't say a word about it. But he gave the entire building the day off. I'm like, he gave the entire building the day off? Like, what? I thought, okay, but Harvey pleaded with me to not write about it, just like he pleaded with me.
I don't remember that shit just because Harvey made me go into work. Like,
well, that's your problem with Harvey. But,
I'm pretty sure I was there too.
Right. Yeah. So, but Jimmy gave everybody the day off, and I'm like, this is not what's supposed to happen in training camp. I mean, I'm not a player or anything like that, but this is not the sound of a coach who's fully invested in being great and doesn't want to do it. So, but I just stuff it away and just say, okay, we write the season preview, you know, the how's the season going to go? And I slip these two little things in like the eighth or ninth paragraph. The story. I just bury them down, but they're there, right?
Why'd you bury them, Jason? Why'd you bury them? Why'd you put them right?
They're burying
why,
them,
why
Jesus,
you put them at the beginning, big dog?
Well, because I was known to stir some shit, but you know, you got to pick how you do it sometimes.
Damn right. Yep.
But I was going to make sure it got reported. You know, I wasn't going to make a big deal about it, but you know, like, is Jimmy invested in this season, right? That was basically the question. Is he into this? And again, not really, in my view. There was the whole Tony Martin thing that I had written, the investigation of Tony and his bankruptcy. But you know, I read all this stuff, and Jimmy sees that in the eighth or ninth paragraph, and I get a call from Armando, and he goes, Jimmy's going to call you out, and he's going to scream at you. Just don't say a word. I'm like, what the fuck, right? Like, and so, okay, that's great. I show up. I walk on the field, Armando. Jimmy comes marching. As soon as he sees me, he marches through all the reporters and does one of these things, right? This does this, and calls us all in, and 13, I lost count at 13 motherfuckers. This is my motherfucking job and my motherfucking this and my, and I'm like, you know, I'm going to call your motherfucking boss. And I'm like, okay, you're losing your mind. Let it go. And I just, as soon as he got done, I walked out on the field. I walked all the way over to the side so that I could just stew in my own juices over there. And I said, okay, we're going to be doing something that's going to get, you know, make this right. And that was sort of the beginning of me doing the medical investigation of the team that came out the following year, because I was going to make Jimmy pay for all the things that he had done. But, you know, the upshot of it is that, you know, he took his lashings. And again, I wrote it. I got to take it. It was his turn to say what he wanted to say. I wasn't going to get in a fight with him. I wasn't going to argue with him. Let him have his say. Let him blow off his steam. Because that's my job. I said my piece in the paper that morning. So he gets to say his piece. And I didn't write any article about what he had done. But it became famous. You know, everybody saw that. Joe Rose was laughing about it all fucking day.
He loves it. But so you're saying admittedly that, all right, okay, you're going to, I wrote what I wrote. You're going to have your moment. But now it's payback.
Oh, eventually. Well, as long as I was writing the truth. And I wrote the truth. And I said, I'm going to chase this stuff down and I'm going to find out what's going on. So it was, you know, you can say it was revenge. If you want to say it was revenge, that's fine. But again, as long as I was writing the truth, I didn't have a single problem with it. And
fair enough.
And apparently, as everybody knows, I found out a whole lot more about what, how Jimmy had handled some, you know, the medical stuff. So, and we'll leave that for another time.
Okay. Me and you, we're going to talk about some shit like that. That sounds good.
And we do have a post-interview process.
Yeah, we do.
We'll get into it.
Yeah, we'll debrief a little bit. Yeah.
Exit.
You know what else, man? I mean, you mentioned it a little bit about my man, Tony Martin, one of my wide receiver room buddies. And you wrote a huge piece on him as well. I mean, it's, if I recall, a lot of it was on Tony's like financial situation. And then, of course, the true story of this offseason was Tony's money laundering trial. And I actually went down there, man. It was one of the scariest things I've ever been a part of in my life. Me and Danny were there. I'm glad they didn't call my ass in the witness stand. Danny came in as a character witness.
That was wild, wasn't it?
Yeah. So talk about how, you know, how you fit into, how do you fit into all this?
It's the funniest thing in the world, right? So he gets popped for money, you know, by the feds in a money laundering case. They're claiming that essentially that he took $90,000 from a drug dealer, and the drug dealer said, go take this cash. It was $90,000 in cash in a bag. We want you, you're playing for, you're living out in San Diego. We want you to fly from Miami out to San Diego, deposit this in your account, in your bank account in California, and then we want you to pay our lawyers. So that's the money laundering side of this. That's what the sort of technicality that the feds were trying to get Tony on, right? Now we'll get back to that in a second. But as part of all this, Tony is going through not only this money laundering charge, which is really serious, right? These drug dealers in, I think it's in Opa-locka, up in north part of Miami-Dade County, you know, where he's from, right?
Right.
And that's where the, you know, he knew these guys from when he grew up. So it's a mess, right? But simultaneously, Tony is going through a bankruptcy. And so I'm like, okay, all of these documents that are filed in his bankruptcy are now open. And those documents include all of the stuff, the testimony, and all of the wiretapping of everything that happened in the money laundering case. So I'm like sitting there, and it's like, again, it's May, June, and I'm working, going down to the courthouse in Miami, looking at all this, trying to piece together what the heck is going on in this guy's life, and how did he end up back here, and what kind of insanity is going on here, and is Tony going to handle this, right? Like, what's he going to do? Is he going to get off? So I write the thing about the bankruptcy, which he's just, basically Tony is just, you know, unfortunately spending money like it's water and not smart with his money. And it's just one thing after another. And then I write the stuff about the money laundering charge. Well, the part of the story about the money laundering charge is, again, let's get back to the $90,000. Basically a grocery bag full of money that the guy hands to Tony and says, we want you to go and deposit this in the bank. And Tony goes, okay, but I got to leave right now. He like stops the conversation after he gets, he goes, I got to go vacuum my house. Like literally in the middle of this whole thing, he says, I got to leave because I've got to go vacuum my house, which was kind of absurd to begin with. He goes home, he vacuums the house. A couple of days later, he comes back and he says,
the house. Do you have that confirmed?
Did he vacuum the house?
Yeah.
I have sources on that.
Okay.
So he thinks about this for a couple of days and he realizes it's probably not a good idea. He doesn't know why, but Tony figures out it's not a good idea to take this $90,000 in cash all the way to San Diego where he has another place to live and deposit it there and then pay. He doesn't know why, but he's like, okay, I'm not going to do this. So he goes back to the jail and to meet with the drug dealer and say, I'm going to give you your money back. Okay, I'm going to give you this money back. But at the last second he goes, oh, by the way, there's like only $81,000 because I needed a little bit of cash. Wait, so he's dealing with a drug dealer in Opa-locka, right?
Wait a minute.
Serious. On the tapes, he says to the drug dealer from Opa-locka, okay, sorry, I took some of your cash. You've only getting like $81,000 back instead of the $90,000. And I'm like, holy crap. Tony.
He was a scary dude, Jason.
What?
Dude was a scary dude. I don't know why. Know Tony,
I didn't know who it was.
Bro, I was in court. I looked at him. I was scared. I wasn't even on trial. I was scared as hell.
$90,000. But the best part of this whole thing, Eric, you know, there's a bunch of guys who are pissed at me because I'm writing about his financial life I'm writing about the fact that he's on a money laundering.
And it was a full pay. I mean, that
it was huge. I still got copies of the article. I mean, it was a huge thing. And Jimmy didn't like it because, you know, it embarrassed Jimmy because Jimmy went out on a limb to hire this guy because he wanted to have a speedy deep threat guy. And that's what Tony could do. Tony could run all day long, right?
Had a great season that year.
Yeah, he's amazing. But like, I'm like, what kind of state of mind is this guy in? What's going on with him? What's going on in his life? Is he going to go to jail or what's going to happen? And the funny part is, like, you know, Trace Armstrong, you know, goes, you better go up to Tony right now and you better go apologize.
Trace was pissed.
Well, all right, that's fine. I'll go. But Stu Weinstein, who you guys have had on a couple of times, I believe, Stu comes up to me. He goes, wow, I read your story. He goes, this is like the greatest defense that we've ever had because it proves that Tony was like too dumb to money launder. There's no way that he could have done that. He took the drug dealer's money. I'm like, thank you. Somebody finally gets the bigger picture of what's going on. But that was $9,000 he didn't return of a drug dealer's money. I was like, that's the ballsiest thing I have ever seen in my life. And yeah. OJ, I guess you're telling me that you concur that it was one of the ballsiest things.
Oh man, bro, it was a very intimidating situation as a as a bystander, not as a witness, not as a defendant, or as anything else. But it was scary.
Yeah, wild stuff.
Yeah,
I'm not even commenting on it. Yeah, talk about stuff. I'm not even commenting on it. You know, we've already had somebody upset with something we said in the tank here, Jews. I don't upset the wrong guy.
Yeah.
So look, another thing, and you alluded to it earlier, Jason. 1999 was essentially the internship year for Dave Wannstedt as the head coach of the Dolphins. You know, there's so much that we could talk about with Dave, and he was here for almost 5 years. In fairness to him. So in fairness to Dave, multiple playoff appearances, the last time this team won a playoff game, he was the head coach, won a lot of games under Dave Wannstedt. I know you have a different view of his tenure. So
okay,
we know you feel a certain way about Dave. But and we can talk a little, you know, I want to hear your thoughts on that for sure.
You know, I think Dave was, I should say this, Dave Wannstedt was a really nice man. I think he really tried hard. But there are some guys who are born to be leaders. And when you're a leader, you can't be afraid to be hated. You don't necessarily want to be hated, but you can't be afraid to do that. And I think that Dave wanted to be everybody's friend. He wanted to be buddies. And when Jimmy would go off the reservation and be really, really angry, Dave was the perfect foil for that. And that worked really, really well. But when Dave was put in a position to lead, he couldn't handle it. And so his ways of trying to motivate players, I don't think he ever read the room particularly well. I remember, OJ, I don't think you were there when he brought in Pat Riley to speak to the team, but there's that famous story about when he brought in Pat Riley and the players walked out of there and went like, oh, that's what a real coach talks like.
Wow. Yeah. That's, you don't want to do that. You don't want to go up in stature. You want to kind of keep somebody.
Yeah, you want to keep it. Like, yeah, you want to keep. Or you know, like Dave. You know, Dave.
I disagree with that, though. I mean, I'm sure it made him look bad because Pat is so dynamic. But you can't be afraid to bring in someone. You know, I think that.
But he was afraid of Mike Westhoff, and you know, and Juice, you know, Mike Westhoff. He was afraid of Mike Westhoff, and he fired Mike Westhoff because he was afraid of him. Okay, because Mike was really smart and would challenge him. And you can't do stuff like that. And then, you know, there was the lobster traps and the mouse traps. And, you know, your boy Jason with the lobster traps. Or, oh, the faith football family thing with the trash can. The football, the Bible, you know, the family picture. You know that one, right? Dave comes in and he does this preseason speech where he's got a trash can. He's got a Bible, a football, at a family photo, and he's got a brick. And he's got a trash can where the football, the family photo, and the Bible all fit very snugly. And he goes, guys, y'all, this is how, if you keep it a priority and you keep faith, family, and football, you know, in a line, it's going to all be good. You know, it's going to fit like this, and it's going to be great. If you see, you know, he took the football out, he took the family photo out, he took the Bible out. But if you put the brick in there, you can't fit everything else in and it doesn't work. You know, and like he tries to put everything back and it doesn't fit, right? He should have just stopped right there. But he went on one more segment. He took the football and he goes, I'm telling you guys, if you do it right, everything will fit. And he tries to put the football, the photo, and the Bible back in, but he forgets the order that they're supposed to go. He then can't get them in. He knocks over the trash can. The football goes flying. The Bible goes flying. The family photo falls. He's already lost everybody in this because instead of being a moment, it becomes a comedy. And Jason takes the trash can and he throws everything into the big dumpster in the back. Dave goes and finds it in the dumpster, puts it back in, and they played the game the entire week because that's just, you know, like how it worked. But Dave just, he didn't know how to read the room. He was a buddy. He wasn't a manager. Because again, a manager knows how to get into a guy's grill. Like Shula. If you did something wrong, Shula will let you know. And whether you were a reporter or whether you were a player, Shula would get in your grill, and he was never afraid to be that guy. He was never afraid to be that leader. Now, he could pat you on the back and tell you, you know, give you an attaboy, but he was not afraid to manage and have people upset with him if the end product was you were going to be a better football team and you were going to win games. Right. And that's what you have to have. And Jimmy, look, there's a lot of faults to Jimmy, but Jimmy was not afraid to be that kind of leader either. You know, he did it differently, but he was not afraid to be that guy. And that's why they were really successful in Dallas. It just didn't work in Miami, especially him and Danny at the end.
And Drew, so there's another story that took place late in the Wanstead era. I doubt you know about it. I think very few people do know about it. But it had major ramifications within the building when it took place. And it led to a feud within the within South Florida media rivals that maybe like Hatfield and McCoy's. You know, and I know you know what I'm talking about, Jason. And that feud still exists today. The High Five Gate. You were part of High Five Gate.
Oh, I was a high fiver. I mean, I admitted it. I admitted that. You know, you got.
So I don't know how Juice is going to feel about this story when he hears it.
Oh, you know, let me get my popcorn ready, man. And I wish I had a cocktail.
I mean, look, there was. I can't remember which story it was. I think it was the final season of Dave. Or no, it was the second.
No, it was the year before. It was
year before.
The
year before. Is that 2005 or 2004?
03. 04 was his final season, and he didn't make it. He stepped down.
Right, 03 is when, you know, he's the year he's running Ricky into the ground for the second year in a row.
Right.
And, like, you know, because Ricky had, like, 15,000 carries in 2 years. Actually, it was 775, but who's counting?
Me.
And me, too.
And Ricky.
Ricky, yeah, Ricky counting.
It got to be a sore spot with Ricky, and I don't blame Ricky at all because he ran him in that final game against the Jets. Like 20 something times when they were already out of the playoffs. But anyways, the week before that. So we're in Buffalo and they get eliminated from the playoffs. The Dolphins get eliminated. And, you know, it's just a progression of years that it's the same story, right? Like the team is just kind of 9-7, 10-6, move along. And you know, it's not getting better. It's not getting a whole lot worse. But, you know, like the days of Zach are winding, you know, are being played out. Sertan, Madison, Jason. Like, you can feel that these years are getting wasted. And so, look, at the end of the day, you know, we're up in Buffalo, and we're sitting in the bar. It's me and a few other reporters, you know, probably three or four other reporters, just six of us. And we're watching Denver play. And Denver winning, I think, was the key to the Dolphins getting eliminated. So at a certain point, like, I'm just tired of watching the season because, you know, even if the Dolphins make the playoffs, it's going to be like a one and done, or they're going to get there, and then they're going to get ambushed by somebody. And it's just not going any direction that's productive. And so I'm just frustrated watching this, like, as sort of as a fan. And I high-five Denver to make some play that sort of ices the game, and I high-five Armando. Because I'm just in frustration, right? And, you know, I'm like, thank God this shit is just over, right? Because I'm tired of watching it. And I said this, you know, on radio with Orlando Alzagari later on to explain it. And I think some people got it, some people didn't. But obviously, somebody who else who was there then went to Harvey and said that I had done that. And then that got to Dave and it got to Wayne. And in the middle of a press conference to announce something, I think that was that Marino that they were announcing or something else?
I think so, yeah.
That they were announcing that Marino was going to take over as, you know, whatever it was.
Right.
Wayne rips me for high-fiving. And, like, this comes out of nowhere. I didn't know that anybody else knew about it. And frankly, I didn't even remember it. I'm like, what? Oh, okay, yeah, that happened, but what is it you guys think happened? You know, and so I like call Harvey and I go, Harvey, what was this? And Harvey goes, well, you did this and you did this. And I go, you're right, Harvey. I'm not ducking that. I did it. But why didn't you call me and ask me what was going on? Why didn't you get my side of the story about it? I would have told you how I felt, and you still could have told Dave and Wayne, or you could have told anybody, but you didn't ask me what was going on. So I was angry with Harvey. Now, some people wanted to know who was the snitch in the room. I never really cared. So when you say Hatfield, McCoy, for some people that might be true. For me, look, I did it. And again, if it was true, that's fine. I got to live with what I did. Okay. I got to own what I did. But bottom line is I had watched all those years of Wanstead and I watched the previous year get wasted. I had watched that year where they lose up in New England and then they lose in Minnesota in the final two games after they had the number one seed. Yep. You know, you're just watching a generational defense and a supreme running back. Just, it's all getting thrown away. And you're going, I know that the man who is the head coach is not capable of taking this team the final distance. I feel it in my heart. I know it. I am frustrated. And that's why, like, after I said what I said on radio, it's funny, Brian Wiedmeyer, God rest his soul, one of the classiest men I've ever met in this business. And, you know, I love Brian Wiedmeyer. He called me up and he said, I trust you were honest. He goes, you were telling the truth and you were speaking from your heart. And I really appreciated that. Now, it didn't mean that I wasn't in trouble with lots of Dolphins fans. And there are probably some Dolphins fans out there who were going to still be pissed at me for doing the high five, who think I was against the team. Really, I was frustrated. I was just frustrated from watching the same shit. And frankly, some fans understood that. And I think some players later sort of understood it too. Not everybody. And if people were pissed at me, you have a right.
Guys might understand it, though, Jason, but even those guys, you talk about a supreme defense, supreme running back, even those guys in their own frustration, and Juice, you could speak to this better than I could, they still want to make the playoffs. They still want to have that shot to continue on. So I think that's where it became such a sore subject. It was like, wait a second, you guys are supposed to be impartial, and we get you're going to
– I had a moment. Look, I will admit it. I had a moment. I had a moment where I let my frustration get away with me. And I'm not saying I was right. I'm owning it. You can say I was dead wrong and I won't disagree with you. I'm just telling you where my head was at.
Right.
At that moment. That's not an excuse. It's not a defense.
Right. It's an explanation.
And if people were pissed at me, so be it. I deserve that. That's fine.
You know what I appreciate about it though? And I'm going to give you my perspective of Jason and Big Seth. You know what I mean? A lot of times, man, I always felt that the media was against us. They wanted us to fail. And to see that Jason actually was pissed off about the where we've been, and that's different. That's a different perspective. You know, there's nothing good, and there's nobody writes positive stories, and you know what I mean? And nobody writes anything positive and expect good reactions from it. You know, only the negative stuff seems to get the positive reactions or the more reactions.
Reaction.
You know what I mean? And I you know, hearing that, I felt a lot of guys in that locker room, especially reporters, wanted bad shit. They didn't care about the team as much. And that was my feeling.
I will say, I dealt with it, whatever it was, good, bad, you just deal with it. But I tell journalism students this all the time. The essence of a story is like Romeo and Juliet. Okay, if you want to break
this
it down.
This is a fish tank first now. We got Shakespeare up here.
We're going to do a little Shakespeare in the fish tank. Okay, I'm bringing it right here. Okay,
that's Stanford education.
It's that Stanford.
That's right. Absolutely. Represent. John Elway, Stanford, the whole thing. Yeah. Anyways, to have a great story, you have to have tension. You know, boy loves girl, but families hate each other. That's Romeo and Juliet. There's tension between the two sides. That's what I tell my journalism students. You're looking for the tension. You're looking, what does the coach want that's better? What does the player want to improve? What is the angst that's driving them? What is this, good, bad, or indifferent? I don't want the team to lose. I'm prepared for if they do. But I will also say, it's a whole lot better to cover a team when they're winning as opposed to when they're losing. People pay attention to your work a lot more when a team is winning. And the locker room is a happier place. That doesn't mean that there's not tension. That doesn't mean that, you know, like people aren't trying to get better or figure it out, all those things that we talk about. But I would have loved to have covered a team that actually won the Super Bowl. That would have been, there's monumental stuff that you write about. There's books you write about stuff like that. You're part of
writing about other people on Dan Marino's birthday.
Yeah.
But
right. Exactly. And I deserve that. Yeah. This fucking guy. but yeah, I mean, that I would have loved to have covered Dan Marino finally winning a Super Bowl.
Yeah.
And that would have been poetic. It would have been awesome. It would have been a spectacular thing. I would have loved to have seen Zach Thomas and Jason Taylor holding up a Super Bowl trophy. Okay. But I'm not paid to cheer. And yeah, one time I high five because the team was lost and I was frustrated because I was watching the same shit and I knew that this team was getting wasted. Yeah. Okay. That's absolutely true. It happened. I had a moment you know, of gallows humor. Be pissed at me if you want. Think what you want. I did my job this way. And I pushed hard to do it. And I tried really hard to be, I wanted to be the best reporter covering the Dolphins at the time. I wanted to be the guy that everybody went to and said, what's going on with this team? And be able to answer that question as definitively as I possibly could. And I tried. And sometimes I did. And hey, we were competitive. Everybody was trying to get their slice.
Well, you know what, Jason, man, as you know, Seth mentioned, beginning of the show, man, you know, you do have a book being released today, you know, and it's only right that, you know, we give a little bit of talk about our man before you start, you know, we start plugging another guy.
Your man, and I love the dude too. I love that fucking guy. And just so we know, if you're from Pittsburgh, okay, I don't know how this works, but it's not F-U-C-K, it's F-O-C-K, or at least that's how Dan said. That fucking guy, you know? And he would do, and I remember that I would wait to ask questions all the time about, is it, and he would walk up, he goes, is this that fucking shit you want to ask me? You know, like all the time, he would do that, like, your throwing motion, did your dad teach you? Is that your big fucking question today? I'm like, great, he was the best. There is no greater thrower of the football in the history, not even Peyton Manning. No greater thrower of the football in the history of this game than Dan Marino. And he's up there in the top, whatever list you want to put together. And he was a joy to watch. I mean, he did some stuff that was the game at Indianapolis in the 99 season before he got hurt, where him and Manning go at it with like, there must have been 80,000 points scored in that fourth quarter. Yeah. And he throws the deep one to Aronde. When Jimmy had told him, don't change the play, and he tells Aronde, change the play. And Aronde's looking at Dan, and then he's looking at Jimmy, and then he's looking at Dan, and he's looking at Jimmy, and he goes, well, he called it. I'll blame it on him if it goes
wrong. Dan's going to touch the ball. You better go with him.
That's one of the greatest plays. But Danny was just, you know, he was just hysterical in his own way, in this deadpan humor. And I just remember 92, I was intimidated out of my mind to talking to Marino. But by 93, I kind of figured out, and he got hurt. And 93 was the best year to deal with Danny because he just didn't give a shit. He wasn't in the middle of it. He was like, ask me anything you want to ask me. I don't give a shit. You know, like, because there was no pressure on him. And so I just remember one day we walked in and they're talking about golf. And he looks over at me, he goes, hey, what do you know about golf? I go, I don't know anything about golf, you know? And he looks at me and goes, same as football. And so, you know, can't like, do stuff like you just bust your balls all the time. And it was everybody in the locker room. But my favorite one is, there was another one that season, it was the commiserate story, where somebody asked him, hey, can you commiserate with John Offerdahl after all the injuries he's gone through, right? And he looks down, he goes, commiz? Ask me something else. I went to Pitt.
I know you love that with your Stanford education.
That was the best. But the 95 season is my all-time favorite with Dan with Marino. Because before that season, that was the year he broke all the records, right? You guys have put together this fantastic team, brought in, you know, like 25 first-round picks. You know, Shula was loading up. The pressure was on, the whole thing, right? Danny's going to break all the records. Team's going to go to the Super Bowl. It's going to be a giant celebration. It's going to be fantastic. So before that season, we had to put together a special section of all the top 10 lists. You know, Danny's 10 greatest yardage games, his greatest touchdown games, all the lists where he comes out. So my editor says, I need two lists from Marino specifically. One is his top 10 favorite opponents, and the other one is his top 10 favorite athletes of all time. And he asked me this before training camp. So I go to Harvey and I say, Harvey, I need this. Okay, I'll get that for you soon enough. But weeks go by and I'm not bugging anybody, not anything, but it's on Harvey's list. And I know if it's on Harvey's list, it'll get taken care of. So we're now like 3 days before the deadline to get this thing done. And I need this top 10 list. And my editor's like bugging me. I go, look, he'll do it when he does it. And, you know, you're going to have to adjust or just deal with it, right? Harvey comes and goes, look, he'll do it today. You come in and meet us at 1 o'clock in that little, there was that little room that was between the weight room and the media room that had the spiral staircase that used to go upstairs. And it was like the secret room where we would go hide to make phone calls. And we were worried that somebody was listening to us through the spiral staircase, right?
As you should have.
All this stuff was going
on. It carried for sure.
Yeah. So Harvey goes, he's ready for you. And I come in, I go into the secret room and close the door, right? It's Harvey, Fudge Brown, bless Fudge's heart. You know, she was the community relations person at the time. And then Dan walks in from the weight room, right? I can see that Dan has had his noontime nap, where he's laying on the tables in the training room and falling asleep, right? He used to conk out for about 45 minutes or something in between practices, juice, usually do something like that.
Absolutely. He had that right, you know what I mean? All kinds of rights that were for everybody else, yep.
Yeah, he got to sleep in the training room. That was his thing, and he would conk out. But I can tell he's just awakened from this because he's, wiping the sleep out of his eyes. So what's this fucking shit you need? And, you know, typical, again, always, what is this fucking shit that you need? And I looked at him, I go, I got two lists for this, and I know, I'm just going to ask these, and whatever I get, I get. I need to know your top 10 toughest opponents. And he's like, Bruce, Claiborne, Klecko, and he stops. I need 10, right? I'm supposed to get, this is supposed to be a top 10. We're done at 3. I'm not saying a word. Because I automatically think in my head, I'm telling my editor, you get 3 and that's all you're getting. Because I am not getting into an argument with Dan Marino about a top 10 favorite or toughest opponents list. I got enough other real shit I got to deal with. All right. I'm going to take my 3 and that's it. Well, Fudge, bless her heart, tries to come to my defense.
He starts giving other players.
And Fudge goes, what about Cornelius Bennett? Immediately. Fuck Cornelius Bennett. Right like that. Just shoots it down. Just like that. I'm going, okay, time's done. Thank you. Okay, let's move on to the next list. Thank you very much. Who are your 10 favorite, your favorite athletes of all time? Okay, we've transitioned. Fudge is now receded off into the side because she's got shot down herself. Fortunately, the reporter doesn't have to take this bullet. Fudge did it for me. Top 10 favorite athletes. Hey, Bobby Clemente, Pops, Willie Stargell, all Pittsburgh guys. Bradshaw stops at 3. I'm good. I'm fine. But I'm going to wait. I'm going to give him the courtesy to see if he goes beyond 3. But we got to 3. I clearly said 10, but we got 3, and that's all we're going to get, right?
Probably all he felt you needed.
This is what my editor is going to get because that's it. I am not fighting with Marino about a top 10 favorite athletes list. That's not going to happen. He stops at 3. Now it's Harvey's turn. Any golfers?
Any golfers?
And with a sneer on his face, he goes, golfers ain't fucking athletes. And it's over. Thank you. We're out. We're gone. You know, it's just classic Danny. Golfers ain't fucking
athletes. I love it.
Outstanding. Danny
was so much fun because he just he was all football. He was just kept it really tight about the game and he didn't really care about the media stuff. He just didn't care about it. It wasn't important to him. He wasn't going to get into a fight. He wasn't going to play games with us. Even when he got into it with Jimmy, and 99 was brutal. That was a brutal, brutal season when those guys went to war. He never went behind anybody's back and gave information to anybody.
That's not Dan.
He never told anybody.
He's not wired that way.
No, he wasn't wired. It was that was him. And I respected that so much about him and how he handled his business in terms of football. And it was great. And I still remember, when he retired, and Juice, I always love this story. But when he called you the toughest football player he's ever played with, I was like, when Dan Marino says shit like that, that got me here, because I'm like that.
Did you cry like I did, stuff. Jason? Did you cry like a baby like I did? I cried like a baby.
Yeah, I'm going to cry. You guys are going to have a little cry. We're going to have a little cry fest when it's all done. We're not doing this on camera, but we'll do it. We'll do it together.
Well, you, on that note, happy birthday to the GOAT, right? Happy birthday,
Danny. Absolutely. Happy birthday, Danny.
Yeah. Hey, I don't know that you get to sit. No, I'm kidding, Jason. No. Happy birthday, Dan Marino. Again, inexplicably, the last quarterback taken in the 1983 draft. If you want to know who the first guy was, if for some reason you don't know, we know who it was. Jason Cole wrote about him. Elway, A Relentless Life, the unauthorized biography. Unauthorized?
Unauthorized.
Went to school with him. He didn't give you a little.
He's waiting to write his own book. He'll make a lot of money. Don't do that.
Got it. Where can people buy the book, Jason?
They can go to your favorite bookstore, if those still exist, and wherever you live, Barnes & Noble, hopefully, wherever that happens to be. But you can go online. You can go to Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com. You can go to Hachette Books, Hachette Books. And any of those three places that will take you to Elway, A Relentless Life, which was years in the writing and researching. I talked to more than 200 people about him. And yeah, Juice, I went to college with him, and I saw him make, like, there are people that you just watch and you go, they are on another planet athletically.
Yeah.
Like Dan Marino.
Dan, no question. Dan was on another planet.
Yeah, athletically. And you saw that a lot with Elway, even later in his career, where he wasn't maybe throwing it as much, but he saw his legs were still active. Still able to run and get the Super Bowl touchdown, things like that. Elway was that dude, man. And it's like Dan, a hell of a baseball player.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he would have been. He was a second-round pick. He played for the Yankees. Used that Yankee leverage to get himself out of Baltimore, you know, which is a big part of – we got two chapters about the whole trade. I know, you know, Shula was thinking about him before the draft. It wasn't going to happen. And then Shula had Marino fall into his lap at the end of the first round, which, you know, made history. That was a truly beginning of the true era of the quarterback. You know, Montana gets it started with the Walsh offense. And then you get the whole class of 83. And ever since then, the last basically 40 years of the NFL, everything is built to highlight the quarterback and make those guys great. And you get to Manning and Brady and Breeze and Roethlisberger and all those guys because of Montana, Marino, Elway, Kelly, all those guys. It just completely opens the era. And so that's a big part of this book. It was a really fun project and a lot of history in it. And, you know, me writing about, yes, my favorite quarterback. And, you know, you guys can rip me all you want for it.
Yeah, we're going to rip you. We're going to give you the blazing. You're in trouble with us, man.
We're editing this shit out right now.
This is like with the Dolphins, right? We're going to kill you on this.
Sacrilegious on my man.
Jason Dole's interview has ended now.
Yeah, so on that note, Jason, you were very gracious with your time. It was great to finally have you in the tank. Certainly appreciate all the downloads you've given us because you've listened to every episode.
Appreciate the love, man.
I get recaps, Juice. Every week he's texting me about, you know, the stories he didn't know, the stories he thought he knew, and now he knows, and we validated this, that, and the other. So we appreciate the support.
We're going to use him as an anonymous source too, Seth. You know what I mean? We're going to use him as an anonymous source.
Any way you want. I deserve that. You can say that fucking guy did that shit. You can say, Jason, you can call me an anonymous source. Do whatever you like.
Thanks for diving in, Jason.
You're now diving into the fish tank.
Sitting down with Seth Living, Seth, OJ, Juice Man, ooh, and this is strictly for them true fans, golf fans, number one. Of course, y'all, this ain't no ordinary sports talk. Dive up in that fish tank. Go get your aqua orange, yeah, it's time to dive up in that fish tank. It's only legendary talking when you dive up in that fish tank. Rocking with OJ and Seth when you dive up in that fish tank. Fans with attitude, okay, we this one for them diehards. Celebrate big or cry hard. Leave it all on the field, we gon' try hard. Old school, a new school, mix it in. Feeling like we up close when we listening. Dolphins tales, in Miami is the deep end. We vibing with our favorite players, no secret. We get with Seth and McDuffie, bringing up stories we never heard to the public. Bet we love it, Dolphins fans never budget. We loyal to the team, whether happy or we upset. We be like, what's next? Don't switch the subject. You know it's all about them fins. And if you ready for that water, time to dive in. Don't switch the subject. You know it's all about them fins. And if you down with Dolphins Nation, time to dive in. Don't switch the subject. You know it's all about them fins. You looking at that fish tank, it's time to dive in. Fish tank. Go get your aqua orange. Yeah, it's time to dive up in that fish tank. It's only legendary talking when you dive up in that fish tank. Rockin' with OJ and Seth, when you dive up in that fish tank. Dog fans with attitude, we about to dive up in that fish tank.